Welcome to episode 26 of Girls on Pop. I am your co-host, Brain Antunes, joined by fellow co-host.
I am Ashley Lynch.
Welcome back to another fabulous discussion of all things movie and TV, all things as like we consume everything, right?
I mean, it's what we do. There's too many things to watch. There are too many things to watch. And
it's true.
Them all, so we do what we can.
This is true. I don't know if it's to make matters more difficult. I've also been reading a lot, which doesn't leave a lot of time for watching stuff. And I should be watching more stuff, but I have been consumed by books lately. So
it's funny you say that because I have too. And reading has been this kind of sore sticking point for me for quite a while because I don't read enough. I mass all these books that I want to read, but I just don't have the time between all my editing work and all the movies I watch and all the TV shows I watch. And eventually I run out of time to read. And so what we did in this other group that I'm in is we decided to start a book club. And so we basically voted on a genre and one person picked a book and now we're going through the book and we're like reading, you know, like 100 pages a week and we're getting together once a week to talk about the book. And it's absolutely wonderful. It's like inserted this structured reading into my schedule that is required of me and I'm loving the hell out of it.
I love your collection. Like you started amassing this collection of like noir pulp books, which is so amazing to me. Like your pictures are so good.
I have become obsessed with this imprint called Hard Case Crime, which reprints a lot. Some of the books are new, like Stephen King apparently is like just on the side putting out like pulp crime novels.
Because of course he is.
Yeah, but a lot of these are like really old novels from like Donald Westlake and Lawrence Block and other writers like that. There's like some Mickey Spillane books in there and there's like some classic like pulp noir novels, which I have a tremendous kind of affection and affinity for. And the cover artwork's so great and the stories are so grimy and they're like nice little mystery novels. I've got my latest one that just arrived right here, Fade to Blonde.
I love that cover. It's so good.
I know. And it's like there's something about 150 books. They've numbered them in the series. So I think there's about 150 books so far. They keep putting out new ones. But I've just decided to start collecting this series of books. And I have probably about 40 of them at this point. And they're nice, easy reads, and they're fun. And it's just like, if you dig that kind of pulp noir novel style, then it's a really cool imprint to get into. So I kind of love that they're doing it, and I want to get all of them.
Oh, that's so awesome. I've fallen down the rabbit hole of, I guess they call it like romantic fantasy. I don't actually even really know what they call it now. There's been since like I've always been a reader, but I was like really into books like 10 years ago. And I'm a book crosser. So for a long time, like books were really a big part of my life. And then I kind of skewed away from it and into movies. But since I've kind of gone back, it's the dynamic and it's changed so much that I feel like I'm this baby reader. Which is like the funniest thing, but it's been really fun to kind of dig into the community and find some new authors I really like. So I've really been enjoying the ride for sure.
So are these books that are sitting like technically in the YA genre? Or
no,
adult fiction.
No, they're fully in. If anything, I would say they're fully in the erotica section of the bookstore. So they are most of them are like high fantasy with. Mm-hmm. A lot of smut, as I like to call it, which is totally fine. I'm there for everything, all of it. Yeah. And it seems a lot of it is written by women. For a long time, women were not really a part of the fantasy genre. So it's nice to see a bunch of new voices. So it's been really fun. It's been really fun getting to know where things are kind of are at and where they're going. So
that's
really
one of the powers of that series, Outlander, where it's basically like high fantasy romantic fiction by women for women.
Well, and I mean, the thing of it is, like Outlander, it wasn't the first book that did it, but it was certainly one of the more popular ones. And I mean, it really did, and especially now, it's influenced an entire subgenre, because all of the books that I've been reading, they stem from Outlander. They're not, most of them are not historical fiction, but they mix the fantasy with the sex. And then a lot of the times the writing is really, really good. You can't knock it. You can't call it chicklet or whatever you want to call it. Yeah. But I don't know. I've been really enjoying it. It's been a lot of fun. But we're already off track.
A lot of those boundaries have crumbled and sort of shifted. It's like
they totally have
applied traditional paradigms to books anymore at this
point. No, you can't. You can't. So it's been a lot of fun, and I've really been enjoying myself. That's all.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So the reading has been fun. But before we like actually start talking about movies, I realize we haven't said where people can find us.
The podcast? I thought this was the book podcast.
We changed the format. Okay. Where can people find you?
The best place to find me is on Twitter at Ashley Lynch.
And folks can find me on Twitter as well at The Marina. But let's jump into what we're here to actually, well, you know, we'll talk about anything, but let's talk about some movies and TV, because that's what we're here for.
It's on pop. Books fit into pop. Wow.
That's right. That's right. Damn it.
Culture of books.
Yeah, you know, we should add more books.
Let's talk about some movies and TV.
Let's talk about some movies and TV. Okay, yeah. So let's start with Spider-Man, because I know you've seen it. I finally caught up with it. I'm not really sure how I feel about this movie. I will say I really enjoyed it. It was a lot of fun, but it felt really exhausting. And I don't even know, like, in what – I don't even know in what way. It just felt overly long. And, like, there was a lot going on. And it's not like I was ever lost. I just kind of felt worn out at the end of it.
I know what you mean. It's a pretty high-intensity film. It's, like, it's at 11 from the word go. And, like, literally go, because it picks up basically the second that the last Spider-Man movie ended. Which is, they're in the street, and J. Jonah Jameson had just dropped Spider-Man's, you know, true identity is, and all these people on the street are like, whoa. And it's just like right from the word go, it's just like it's hyperactive all the way to the end of the film. And it is a lot of fun. I did enjoy it. I don't think it's exhausting the way that the Batman is exhausting. It's exhausting in a different way.
Yeah.
And I mostly did like the film. I think it is a very good movie. Is it in Should it be nominated for best film like some people are suggesting? No. No, it's not that good. I think we can calm down a little bit on the Spider-Man love, but it is fine to say that this probably is the best of the three Tom Holland movies, I think.
I would agree with that. I wish the only thing I cause they seem to have finally like they from the get-go they really dialed in the three lead characters whose names I've completely forgotten because that's just the way my brain works. But it's they kind of
Ned and MJ.
Yeah, that's right. They kind of started to build that relationship, and the banter there was so good and so natural. Mm-hmm. And I thought fine in this movie, they like really nailed it. I just wish there was more of it. I mean, you can't really just make up scenes for the hell of it. But I kind of wish they had. Because I do like the three of them interacting.
I like that overall. They felt like a unit.
Yeah.
Like they felt like a team for the first time.
Yeah, for sure.
The first movie is like, okay, Peter Parker's figuring out his own thing, and then Ned is like trying to be the guy in the chair and help him out. And by the end of the movie, that's sort of like his role. And then second movie is like, well, should I tell MJ or should I not tell MJ? And that becomes a big thing. It's like bringing her on board. And now it's like we start this movie off, his two friends, they're on board, they're on Team Spider-Man. And the entire movie is the three of them as a unit working towards a goal.
Yeah. And
there's like a real kind of like unbroken team camaraderie between the three of them. And they're all incredibly personable and fun to watch together because they have this great dynamic where MJ is like this weird kind of like depressive optimist. Which kind of counterbalances off of like Ned's naivete. And Spider-Man's eternal, we can do it somehow, you know, kind of attitude. And it's like, when they come together, it's just like the interactions between the three of them is it's a lot of fun to watch.
I agree. So, I mean, overall, I thought this was a lot of fun. I'm not disappointed that I saw it. I don't know if they're going to make any more, but I would probably watch more if they weren't 3 hours long.
Yeah, that remains to be seen because it's, from what I understand, Marvel basically is allowed to use Spider-Man in one more event film. So not a standalone Spider-Man film, but just include him in some other Marvel movie. And then after that, the deal between Sony and Marvel is essentially done. And Sony just has total rights of it. Now, it stands to reason that they're going to strike some new deal because obviously this has been a very lucrative partnership. Sony would be foolish not to. But at the same time, there's a lot of money on the table there. And I got to imagine some people at Sony are saying, why are we sharing this pot with Marvel when people will come and see whatever Spider-Man movie we make and we don't have to share it?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, because this movie made all of the money. This movie sucked up all of the oxygen at the box office when it was out there. So it's what the future is theatrically for Spider-Man remains to be seen at this point. But I have to imagine Marvel's going to be back in the mix on it.
I would agree. Talking about something different. I was trying to find like a great segue and it just is not happening. Deepwater.
That was the perfect segue. There's never been a better segue in history.
I haven't seen this yet. I there was a list of things that I wanted to watch before we recorded again. This was on that list and it just sadly didn't make it. So please talk to me about Ben Affleck and his ex-girlfriend in a movie together.
Okay. So I think that's how most people are probably going to come to this movie, with the fact that Ben Affleck and Ana de Armas made this film basically while they were dating, and then they broke up after the movie was made, but before it got released, which puts the movie in a weird kind of position where it ends up being just like the real life drama that is fueling the expectations for what this movie is. So it's already in a weird place. Maybe a better way to benchmark this film is to say that it's Adrian Lin's return to making films after 20 years. His last movie that he did was Unfaithful in, I think, 2002. And here he is coming back, making another kind of like our marriage is on fire thriller. Which is like, you know, that's where he lives and breathes, basically. So 20 years later, he's coming back and making a movie. And it's also based on a Patricia Highsmith novel, the author of Strangers on a Train. And also the, what's that book series? The ones that they did an adaptation with Matt Damon, where he's the basically a psychopathic impersonator.
Talented Mr. Ripley.
Yeah, Talented Mr. Ripley, the Ripley series of books. There's like about like six or seven books in that series or something like that. And so she's the author of those books. And so we have this incredibly, you know, acclaimed mystery writer. This book is from like 1967, so it's been around for a while. And it's being adapted by Adrian Lin, and it's starring a couple who at the time was in an actual relationship. Now, the fact that the relationship has dissolved since, I think only helps the film, because as soon as we enter this story, it's about a married couple that is in a really bad toxic state where they don't even really like each other very much. She's openly flirting around and sleeping with guys on the side. And they seem to have like some sort of unspoken agreement that he's okay with this, even though he's not really okay with this. And they don't even really have much of a relationship together anymore. And he's a weird guy. And it does this classic Patricia Highsmith thing where it's like, we're going to spend the first half of the movie basically twisting the screws of the dramatic relationships and getting everything in place. And then we're going to start to get into some murder. And by this point, all the elements are in place and everything's sort of like the pieces are moving around the board in a way that feels realistic and like everyone's making the decisions you'd expect them to make. But it also starts spinning out wildly out of control, as things like this often do, to the point where you get to the end of the movie and like everything is a complete mess. And this is classic Hitchcock type of territory film. And for that, I absolutely loved it, because this type of genre in particular, I mean, we were talking about those pulp noir novels earlier in the podcast that I'm consuming, like, you know, like candy. This is very much lives in the exact same realm, where it is just like a fun, nice little nasty mystery thriller of a murder story. And I really dug it. It's great performances. It's very well made. I loved it. And that's going to be, I'm going to be biased because this part, genre in particular, is very much my jam. It's my jam. It's my peanut butter. It's my bread. It's all of it. So I was already primed to kind of like this film, and it's a very good film for what it's trying to do. So I highly enjoyed it and I recommend it. I think a lot of the people who have been, because there's been a lot of division on this film. I was reading through some of the reviews, and it seems like a lot of people were watching it expecting it to be like a Joe Esterhaus trashy erotic thriller. It's not that. It was never going to be that. It opens up with this incredibly toxic marriage of people who don't really love each other anymore. You know, so it's the, I think the weird expectation some people are coming into this with because of real life drama is what's stopping them from actually enjoying the movie that it is.
Oh, okay. I'm excited because I really like Unfaithful and I've loved his films and I miss those types of movies. I really, really do. So I'm excited. I'll definitely watch this before we record again. It's high on the list now.
Yeah, it absolutely fits into that arena of like, God, I wish they made movies like this still.
Yeah. Oh, yay. Yay. Okay. Something to look forward to. I love it.
Okay. So that was my little deep water rant.
I love it. I won't talk too much about this. I'm actually not sure if you've seen, have you seen Licorice Pizza?
I haven't yet. It's seen in my to watch pile, but I've not gotten around to it yet.
So I won't talk too much about it. So this is the new Paul Thomas Anderson, starring Alana Haim and Cooper Hoffman. I like PTA. I generally just really, really enjoy his movies. I tend to like his period pieces more than I like his contemporary films. This is a period piece. It's set in the 70s, but it feels contemporary in just the way that he's a storyteller. It's super charming. The script is really well written. Great dialogue. Wonderful sort of like relationship. It's about this very young man who's like a trying to break into acting, and you know, he meets this older girl. I want to say older woman, but she's not really a woman. She's also a girl, but she's a few years older than him. And it's about how they sort of dance around each other as this relationship grows over a period of years. It's really, really sweet, very charming, really well shot. It's just a really nice feel-good movie. It's just so sweet. I love that. I thought it was really, really romantic. So Licorice Pizza gets my vote of approval.
I'm looking forward to it because just judging from the trailers, I was looking at going, okay, it sort of feels a little bit like Wes Anderson returning to like his, you know, Boogie Nights, you know, Magnolia days with like the type of kind of like, I want to say whimsical film, but whimsical is not the right word for it. But like this nice little like slice of life type of comedic film even that he had kind of gotten away from doing when he started to get into more kind of serious and dour stuff, like doing, you know, There Will Be Blood and The Master and
yeah,
you know, even Phantom Thread and stuff like that. And it's nice to see what feels like a little bit of return to form and return to play.
It totally is. Like, I love the dark films. I love PTA in dark movie mode, but this is a nice light. And I mean, and I say light doesn't, like, the story is just very sweet and sort of lightweight, but the movie is not. Like, it's clearly made by somebody that knows how to handle a fucking camera like no other. It's just, it's this beautiful mix of just like a really nice movie that's like exceptionally well made. And Alana Haim is so good on screen. She just has this like magnetic energy. Cooper Hoffman, I'm not quite sure about. I think this is the second thing I've seen him in, and I'm still kind of on the fence. He just feels very awkward, and it plays into the character, which is really nice, but I don't know if he can do more than that, because everything I've seen him in, he's kind of playing the same kind of guy. But Alana Haim, what a find. She's really, really good here. Really, really good. And Sean Penn shows up in like the creepiest of roles. It's so good. It's so good. I highly recommend it. I thought it was very, very sweet and charming.
I'm looking forward to watching this, if for no other reason, to see Bradley Cooper essentially being John Peters.
So good.
If you've watched Licorice Pizza and you're like, oh my god, that's John Peters guy, I suggest reading the book Hit and Run, which is all about the time that John Peters was basically heading up, I believe it was cool. Was it Columbia or Warner? I can't remember. He was head of the studio for a while. He was responsible for producing Tim Burton's Batman movie. You know, it's like there's a lot of infamous stories, and most of the biggest infamous story that people are familiar with is Kevin Smith's story about dealing with him on the Superman movie, and how he wanted a giant spider in the movie, and it ended up in Wild Wild West. But yeah, John Peters. Real character kind of guy, and he's actually in this movie,
and it's wild. It's pretty great.
I'm looking forward to it.
Let's talk about The Adam Project, which we've both seen. This is the new Sean Levy movie, which is now available to stream on Netflix, starring Ryan Reynolds and the kid that is like Ryan Reynolds Jr.
Yeah.
Walker Scoble is his name.
I'll let you go first on this, because I still haven't decided how much I want to go off.
So, I mean, I don't know. I think one of the reasons this movie works is because they found somebody that has the same like swagger and energy. He really does feel like Reynolds Jr. Like, it's the same kind of energy, and I think that's the only reason the movie works. I like some aspects of it. I think the story is fucking ridiculous. I think it's so stupid. And when you really think about it, it makes no sense. And I hate movies that fuck with the time travel in a way that doesn't make sense. Like, you just kind of wrote it and you didn't think about like the whole thing. It's a mess. That said, it was a lot of fun. Some of the effects are really cool. Like, I'm a big, like, for some reason, the whole like disintegrating bits thing really got me going. Like, there's a sequence in the backyard when you first meet Zoe Saldana where they have like this big fight sequence and there's all these bodies disintegrating everywhere. To me, that was like the greatest scene. I don't know why, it just kind of, it just got me. I watched that thing twice, but that was the only part of that movie I watched twice. The rest of it's just kind of like a mess. And Catherine Keener is just like, and the de-aging just doesn't work. I don't know. There's so much I don't like about this movie, but it's fun, I guess. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I throw up my hands because I have no idea what else to say.
You confusedly endorsed the film.
I think I did, didn't I? Because I did. I mean, I did have fun. I just don't think it's a great movie.
I know what you're talking about. So I'm probably a little bit more down on the movie than you are, even though I agree with pretty much everything that you're saying. I mostly didn't like the film after I watched it, and then the longer it sat with me, the more I began to resent this film. I think the place I've landed on right now is it seems like this movie was written by a machine learning algorithm that was trying to capitalize on nostalgia without requiring any licensing of IP to do it. It feels like this movie was made without any human intervention whatsoever. I agree that the whole premise of Ryan Reynolds going back in time and having to get into an adventure with his 12-year-old kid version of him, and you have Ryan Reynolds doing his like you know, post-ironic shtick, and then the kid is also doing the post-ironic shtick, some of that stuff works, and some of that is also, like, you can't have a movie with two comic reliefs and no straight man. It's too much. But the biggest problem to me, like, on a technical proficiency level, this movie's great. It's got great actors. It's got some, you know, it's shot really well. Some of the effects are cool. Everything going on in front of the camera is like, sure, it's fine. It's good. Well done. The story for it, though, is absolute garbage. And I don't think it's just the time travel stuff that doesn't work, even though the time travel stuff doesn't work or make any sense. The rest of the story doesn't make any sense. I got a half hour into this movie and I still couldn't tell you what the stakes were or what any of the characters wanted. That's a problem. And this movie doesn't really have a story. It just has a couple ideas like, hey, it sucks when your dad's not around. So maybe you can be your own dad, but also let's go find dad because we have daddy issues. And remember Amblin films? Those were fun. Hey, this is kind of like a lightsaber, but not really a lightsaber. Want to play with some lightsabers for a while? And so the movie just bounces between stuff that feels kind of familiar, even though it's not, and distracts you with a lot of snarky banter from two characters doing the exact same shtick and VFX spectacle.
Yep.
And it's kind of amazing how much the film is actually able to distract you with this to convince you that it's entertaining throughout the film when absolutely nothing is happening. You get to the end of the movie. What was it about? I still don't know what this movie is about. Stuff happened, but I can't tell you what any of it meant or what it was driving towards. So it's, you know, this is the prototypical entertaining but mindless movie because it's like pretty images, but it amounts to absolutely nothing.
I fully agree, except you thought about it after it ended, and I did not. Literally, the credits rolled, and I'm like, fuck this movie. I've watched it. Next one.
See, I woke up the next morning, and it's like, yeah, I think I did really hate that movie.
I didn't really give it a second thought once it finished. That was I was like, okay.
I continued to remember it existed.
I will say, if I remember right, we both liked Free Guy quite a bit.
I liked most of it. I think it fell apart in the last third, but I thought the first two thirds of it were really strong, and I liked it a lot more than I thought I was going to like it. My bar was set really low for it.
So I would say if you're looking for a Sean Levy, Ryan Reynolds team up, watch Free Guy instead.
Free Guy is a better movie.
Yeah.
Although I just want to add this on, the thing that blows me away is I learned this movie, they spent $175 million on.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's, I don't know, it's kind of depressing because it's like the last three, Netflix clearly wants to be in the Ryan Reynolds business for obvious reasons. And they're sinking a lot of money into Ryan Reynolds projects. And like the last three films that I've seen with Netflix and Ryan Reynolds, we've got Six Underground, we've got
Red Notice,
and then we've got this. I actively dislike all of these movies. And they
they're
were
zero for three.
Successful. They got a lot of watch time off of these three movies and can continue this relationship. I would love to see Ryan Reynolds do great movies on Netflix, but these aren't it.
I agree. I didn't dislike Red Notice. I thought it was just whatever. But I mean, I'm with you. I mean, if they're going to keep spending the money, I'd rather they make something more interesting. But thankfully, Ryan Reynolds is still doing stuff outside of Netflix. And some of that stuff looks more interesting. So hopefully that'll continue as well. But yeah, this was just very kind of miss for me. Like you say, I mean, I kind of endorse it because it was okay. But I wouldn't say, yeah, watch this. It's not the first thing that would come to mind. I'll probably forget about it next week. One movie that I won't forget about, and this came as kind of a surprise. I'm trying to catch up on some of the like award season buzzy movies that have been floating around, because I find that if I don't watch them while they're still in the conversation, they kind of fall off my radar, and then it'll be years before I watch them. And I really like Mike Mills. Yeah, and I really like Mike Mills. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to watch Come On, Come On. Even though Joaquin Phoenix is kind of like this guy, I'm still not quite sure how I feel about him. I think he's a great actor, but I have problems with him, but whatever. That's besides the point. Come On, Come On is this amazingly charming movie that took me completely by surprise. I wasn't really sure what to expect. I didn't know what it was about. I knew it was about Joaquin Phoenix and this kid, like basically hanging out for like 2 hours. I think the movie is 2 hours long. It turns out to be this really sweet, kind of like self-discovery movie about this guy who ends up babysitting his nephew for a slightly extended period of time while his sister is dealing with her husband who has mental issues. It's not really about that, but it kind of is about that. It's also about like siblings and relationships and what could have been and what really is. And it's just like this sort of like slice of life movie for like 2 hours. It's just like Joaquin Phoenix literally talking to this kid who could have been his son. Like for a while, I'm like, are you his dad? Like the absentee father that just kind of pops in when needed, because it kind of feels like that. I don't know. This movie just, it's just super charming. Phoenix is really good. The kid is really great. What we see of Gabby Hoffman is wonderful. It's beautifully shot in this very stark black and white. It's just so nice. And it's bookmarked by Joaquin Phoenix in his like full-time job is, I don't think he's like a documentary filmmaker, but he works with a documentary filmmaker and they're working on a project where they're talking to kids about their future. So the movie is peppered with these interviews that he's doing with like elementary school kids and high school kids talking about their futures and what's coming. And it's just like a really nice reprieve. The movie just, it doesn't really fit into one category. It's just charming as hell. Really, really sweet. It really surprised me. I highly recommend it. I urge you to seek it out. It's wonderful.
This one's been sitting in my watch list, so I will get around to it eventually, but I have not yet.
Yeah, it's a pretty good one. I was impressed by it. Talk to me about Windfall.
Yeah, so I watched this one. I'm very fresh. I watched this one last night at like 1 a.m. Because I didn't even know this movie existed. This one fits in the category of Netflix released a cool movie, and because Netflix doesn't do any goddamn advertising for their films, it just completely slipped me by. This one is a tight little, I could call it a fluffy film noir mystery or thriller. Because it has a much lighter tone. But the premise is basically Jason Segel is a guy who is broken into a resort home of a tech billionaire played by Jesse Plemons to rob it when unexpectedly he shows up with his girlfriend for the weekend and Jason Segel ends up like stuck in the situation where he has to basically take them hostage. And he's like, oh God, I have to disappear now. You see my faces. It's like, I need more than like the $5,000 I found in your house. And so he's like, okay, well I can get some money here. I can get some real money for you to disappear. No one needs to get hurt, but it's going to take some time. And you know, it's like, he calls his assistant. It's like, I can get to you tomorrow. And so they basically have to hang out, the three of them. And the other character is played by Lily Collins, his girlfriend. And they have to hang out at this, you know, resort home and wait for the money to show up. And you end up with that, like I was talking earlier about, like, set the pieces and let the screws slowly tighten sort of thing. Whereas, like, you have this kind of, he's not really a violent criminal, but he's forced in a situation where he's had to take these people hostage. So he's not like overly aggressive about it. And then you have Jesse Plemons, who's this douchebag tech bro who's trying to control the situation. And then his girlfriend, who's feeling very kind of marginalized by him already. And Jason Segel is able to like get between them and start to twist the relationship so they are starting to get at odds with each other. And it's this nice little three-header of a thriller story that takes place over the weekend at this cottage. It's like, this is something that feels like it could be like, you know, a one of the nicer little almost comedic like Donald Westlake novels or something like that. But this one is actually written by Andrew Kevin Walker, who wrote the screenplays for Seven and 8mm and has spent basically the last 20 years as like a script doctor on like everything. I mean, like punched up all of David Fincher's films, even if he wasn't able to get credit for them. So he's been around and working for a long time, but he hasn't got a lot of credits to his name, unfortunately. And this is one where he does get a credit. And it's not as dark as like 7 or 8mm by a long shot. It's actually a very fun, breezy, perfect Sunday afternoon movie. But I really enjoyed it. It was really nice. And again, I did not know this thing existed until someone mentioned it to me. It's just sitting there on Netflix waiting to watch. So wonderful little film noir thriller, Windfall.
That's awesome. I really like Jesse Plemons. So when I saw that he was in this, I'm like, okay.
Yeah,
this will be interesting. Exactly. That's awesome. I caught up with something that just landed on VOD. It's a movie from a couple of years ago called Ultrasound. It's the debut of Rob Schoeder. He directs a lot of TV and a lot of like web stuff. I think he does a lot of the Variety Actors on Actors stuff. So he does like stuff, but this is his first feature film. And I thought I was interested in this one because it stars Breida Wool, who I really liked. She was in Unreal, which is a TV show that I recommend to everybody. That show was genius. And she was one of the contestants in one of the seasons. And she was very, very good in that. And so whenever I see her, I'm like, oh, okay, well, let's watch that. So the premise to this is super interesting. She plays a scientist. Well, I don't know if she's a scientist. She's like a psychologist who is doing research on like abuse victims and basically like getting over abuse. And so she gets hired by this company that is doing similar research, but for other reasons. But you don't know that when the movie starts. It's the entire thing is just like one big clusterfuck. Like the movie starts and you're like, what is this? And then it devolves from there and you get all the little pieces here and there. I loved it. I thought it was, it's not genius, but it's just smart enough to get itself into a little bit of trouble. It's so good. It has some like really like snazzy action sequences. I didn't love the ending. I don't think that it's fleshed out as much as it needs to be, but the ride is totally worth it. Like it's only 90 minutes long. Totally worth it. Even if the ending didn't fully work for me, I'm sure it'll work for other people. I didn't think it kind of sold it enough, but it's just so unexpected. And just like this little mindfuck of a movie, I was totally in from the get-go, to the point where at one point I rewound 20 minutes because I'm like, did I miss something? This is how much this movie fucks with you. But it works. It totally works. I really liked Ultrasound. It's so good. And the name, the title does kind of play into, it's explained sort of in a roundabout way. But yeah, if you have the opportunity to see it, it's on VOD. Highly recommend it. It's a great little mindfuck of a movie. Right. Ultrasound, it's called.
My watch list.
I really liked it.
I love how that's one of the best selling points these days. It's only 90 minutes long.
All right. Hey, there has to be something here, right?
There's too many things.
That's right. Talk to me about Black Crab, which is another movie that's on Netflix that I really want to watch and I haven't gotten around to yet.
Yeah, this is another one I watched last night. I think it just dropped on Netflix.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a Swedish thriller, I guess is the best way to put it, with Noomi Rapace, where it's basically in the not too distant future. Basically, it's kept kind of vague-ish, but basically war has broken out, and the entire country of Sweden is like in turmoil essentially. And it opens with her basically being separated from her daughter as people attack, and then we catch up with her immediately after, where she's essentially been conscripted as a soldier, and she's given this mission of, you need to go do this thing. That's just all there is. And there's like these five other guys and her are basically sent on this mission where they have to carry this mysterious package that they're not told what it is, across the ice to its destination, and deliver it. And they're basically just like on ice skates going across this vast field of ice to the north to try to deliver this package that's necessary for their military strategic deployment. And it actually becomes an incredibly intense thriller. There's some incredibly striking and haunting scenes that come as just a result of the environment in which they're trying to cross. It's like no other film in that way. And apparently a lot of it ended up being done practically, which kind of blew me away. I was watching the film going, this has to be CGI. There's no place in the world where you can capture this imagery. There's no way you can like show like, you know, 40 bodies like partially submerged in the ice with their like arms and feet sticking out and stuff like that. This has to be done with digital effects. And apparently no, it's all done for the most part practically, which is kind of astonishing. And it's also a very it's obviously going for a very kind of humanistic look at war, where it doesn't really paint good guys and bad guys, but more just like people who are like exhausted by and just having to deal with a shitty situation on all sides, and which kind of feels prevalent today, which they obviously could not have anticipated a war between Ukraine and Russia at the time that they made this movie. But on another level, it maybe could have kind of dropped at a better time if you look at it through that lens. So it's not a great movie, I would say. Like it doesn't quite get there to become great, but it is really good. It has some incredibly tense moments, has some incredible imagery in it. Noomi Rapace is great, as always. I'll watch anything with Noomi Rapace because I love her. And it's just a solid, good little thriller of a film. So I recommend it.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, I really liked the trailer when I saw it, so I was curious about it. It's good to hear that it delivers some of the goods. I'll definitely have to check that one out. I have a couple that you've seen that I finally caught up with. I finally watched The Nighthouse. I made a point of watching this before we talked again. This, you did recommend this one, right? Or was it somebody else? Okay,
this one was on my top 10 for the year.
Okay, that's why it was so familiar, and I moved it up the list for a reason, so this must have been the reason. This movie, there was a point in this movie where I was like, I literally said to the screen, what the actual fuck? Because I'm still not sure I fully understand it, and I really want to watch it again because I'm sure that it maybe makes more sense the second time around. I can't figure out if it's, and maybe it's all of these things. I'm trying to figure out, is it a haunted house movie? Is it a movie about, you know, the hidden things of relationships? Is it both of those things? Is it a movie about grieving? Is it a movie about, like, things that happen in your past? it's all of those things, and it feels like maybe it's more, maybe it's not about any of those things. I'm not sure.
I mean, short answer is it's all of those things. All of
this is it. It's just, there's so much in this movie, and it's not that it's like, it's just such a mind fuck. It ended and I'm like, I need to watch this thing again. To me, it feels like the remake of The Invisible Man, which was this movie that shouldn't have worked, but was like on another level of genius. This feels kind of like that. Like, it's a movie that maybe shouldn't work, but it totally does. And it works on like an emotional level. It's so good. And it's creepy as fuck.
I think that's the thing I found most interesting about it, and I think why you're having like a hard time like putting your finger on exactly what this film is doing, is that it is essentially doing like a haunted house type story, but it's far less interested in the plot of it and unveiling what the mystery is, which isn't really fully explained by the end of the film, or it's kind of alluded to, and there's enough pieces there that you can sort of like get a sense, but you don't feel like, oh, I know at the end of this film. But it is emotionally felt, and it is very much about Rebecca Hall's emotional journey that she's going on. And that's where like the real kind of like meat and conclusive kind of arc of the film lands, which is incredibly rich. She's incredible in this film. You know, it's possibly the best performance I've seen from her, and she's given some great performances.
Yeah, this movie is like on another level. Like I say, I need to watch it again. I feel like, emotionally, I feel like it totally worked. And in my mind, like, I know that it's a good movie, but I feel like I need to make sense of it. And my brain hasn't processed it yet. I've been sitting with it for like 4 days and I still don't, it hasn't fully sunk in, but there's some of the images are so striking, like her falling backwards in like slow motion. And there's another scene where, she's having a conversation with this disembodied voice that she thinks is her husband. And it's not, like, there's just these moments that are just so intense and so beautiful. And yeah, at one point I was like, what the actual fuck? Like, literally I said that to the TV. I need somebody.
I probably mentioned this before, but one of the things that makes me so excited about this movie and why I was so excited to see it to begin with is the guys who wrote this movie. I can't quite remember their names right now. But they had originally pitched a movie to Dimension for one of the Hellraiser sequels that basically Bob Weinstein, you know, kind of like, now we're never going to make that movie. And they had all this work that they put into this Hellraiser sequel that they wanted to do, which was essentially this story. And so they took what they were working on for a Hellraiser sequel and they made this movie. And now these guys are going to be writing, and David Bruckner, who directed this film, is going to be directing the Hulu Hellraiser reboot. So this kind of gives you a taste as to where these guys kind of land at this. And you can sort of see that skeleton in this a little bit. It gets to a point where it's like, wait, did this guy accidentally open up a portal to hell and that's where her husband went? It kind of like pushes in that direction a little bit, and you can see where this could easily be a Hellraiser movie. So given how much I liked The Night House, I'm really looking forward to their Hellraiser reboot.
I mean, I would, if you said Hellraiser, I'm all in, like knee deep, bring it on. I will also say I actually have seen David Bruckner's other films. Both The Ritual and Southbound are really good. I would recommend both of them. VHS has, you know, it's an anthology movie. Some of it's good, some of it's not. But generally speaking, I've had really great, I've really enjoyed David Bruckner's movies. So I'm really, really looking forward to their continued working together, because it's working for me in a big way.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then I'm like, we can't, literally last night, I'm like, Dan, we have a movie we have to watch. I need to watch this before I talk to Ashley again. I'm not even joking. And this is how I sold him on it. I'm like, because Rotten Tomato scores, I could give a fuck. I don't care. I could care less. But Dan still looks at them. So I'm like, listen, it's 85% fresh. And the rating is like 82 or something percent for the people. When is it ever that close? This is how I sold Dan on it.
Okay.
And of course, I'm talking about fresh. Mimi Cave's movie with Daisy Edgar Jones and Sebastian Stan. And can I just say this
movies that you say back to the TV, what the fuck?
Again, I legitimately said that to the television, except this time Dan was sitting beside me, half asleep, because I think at some point he did doze off. But it was very late. In his defense, it was very late, and I was convinced I needed to watch this movie. This is so in my wheelhouse. I can't even begin to tell you how much I love this movie. It has all the things happening for it that are like, Marina. Yeah. So there's a lie. There's a moment when they go home. They go back to her apartment after their first date, and she offers him a drink. And I wrote this down. This is how much I like this line, because it's the kind of thing I would read in one of the books that I've been reading lately. She's like, can I get you something to drink? And he's like, no, just you. And then they proceed to have like mind blowing sex. And I was like, okay, this movie gets me. It's so batshit crazy. It gives you enough of this other like crazy world of eating women, cannibalism people. I want more, and I don't want more. Like, I want to know more about this universe, and I don't want to know anymore.
Yeah,
it's just so good.
I didn't really spoil what the
oh, I totally too much. Sorry, people.
When we talked about it before, but now that like Kat's out, we're talking about this thing fully. My what the fuck moment with this film was basically the moment which you figure out what Sebastian Stan's deal is in this movie. And his deal is that he is basically the HelloFresh for boutique high-end cannibalism, where he kidnaps girls and basically maintains them. Essentially, it's like livestock, I guess. And then chops them up and delivers. He like is making packages of like, here's my HelloFresh boxes of gourmet human meat that go out to the people who subscribe to my service. That's what it is. And I've never seen that before. It's the first film I've seen that has done the HelloFresh cannibal angle. And I thought it was, I can't believe it took me this long to actually see a movie that had this in it.
You know, for me, I like full props to Lauren Kahn, who wrote this thing. Girl, you are my girl. I love it. There's just so much here that I just love. It's feisty. It's smart. The moments of levity in this movie are amazing. The fact that he takes her, he cuts her butt cheeks. And then for like the rest of the movie, she's like constantly limping, even when they're trying to get away because she can't walk properly. Just like stupid little things like this that totally work. And I love nothing more than like an oddball dance sequence in a movie. And this is like right up there with the best of them when they have their like fancy dinner.
Like Ex Machina.
Yes, yes. The other one that I really like is Beau Travail has that beautiful one as well. So, I mean, I love just like unexpected. I mean, they have another dance sequence at the beginning, but it feels more natural. This one just totally feels like out of left field. And then they do the little choreographed dance that's so awkward. But the song is in Spanish and the lyrics to the song are so against the actual music of the song. Like it feels upbeat and sweet and the lyrics are not. Totally plays into it. It's genius. It's just genius. I love this movie so much. Love it. I want all the making ofs. I want all the special editions. I need this thing in 4K Blu-ray. Just give it to me. Give it to me. I need it.
And it's such a strong outing. Yes. I believe this is their first feature film. It's so confident.
Yes.
It knows exactly what it's trying to do at any given point in time. It is not afraid to be vicious. It is not afraid to be sweet. And it just like hits this like perfect tone. A tone that you literally have to walk out on a tightrope to hit, and it nails it.
Yeah, and I love how much there is of like the, like I love movies like this that they give you like just enough of a taste of what might have happened, and you kind of lets you fill in the blank. Like, the whole thing with his wife totally makes me think like I kind of want another movie, but maybe not. Yeah. The thing with the delivery service. I this have, could be so I much have bigger. So
many questions about that relationship,
right? You know, but right.
At the same time, I feel like I have enough pieces that I can construct like what's going on there. And
yes, yes, it's just so good. This is so my jam. I love this movie so much.
And it's a movie that keeps twisting too. Every time you think you know what direction it's going, it finds another way to kind of twist it out of control. And it's like I kind of likened it to Psycho a lot in that way.
Yeah.
Where it's like you feel like you're watching one movie, it's like, okay, now we're going this direction. It's like, okay, well, that just like changed things dramatically.
For sure. For sure. There's so many moments like that. Oh, so good. So, yes, highest recommendation for me. I'm love glad this movie. You dug it. Oh, yeah, so much. I'm not sure Dan has the same level of excitement I do for it, but that's the point.
Are you saying he didn't have an appetite for it?
Zing. Zing, 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 zing. Yeah, I think I was more ready for it than he was, but whatever. Let's talk about some TV. And I'm curious about this because I actually didn't realize this was a thing. Phoenix Rising.
Yes.
I had to look this up because I hadn't heard about it. So can you tell me a little bit more about this?
I heard about this. I can't remember what film festival was screening it recently, but that's where I heard about it. Excuse me. And it was about 6 months ago, I guess, when it was playing. And like the other thing that occurred at the same time as a result of this documentary finally being in the public eye at film festivals was a lot of new press about allegations against Marilyn Manson. Mm-hmm. And all this flood of information that came out was like, oh, shit, this dude is a monster like you actually did not understand. Like, not only is he abusive, he is way beyond abusive. The dude's just like a legit Nazi. And I guess shocked face, but at the same time also disappointing. And I watched this documentary, which is essentially her recounting of it's two things simultaneously. It's her recounting of her relationship with Marilyn Manson, and the kind of trauma that she sustained, but also how that trauma has affected her all these years later, and also how hard it was to get out of that relationship. And it really kind of wants to focus on the learned stuff about, you know, it's kind of like come from the Marilyn Manson gossip, because that's what you're showing up for anyways, because we're human and we get suckered by that stuff really easy. But the real meat is seeing what the lasting trauma was from it years later and how it actually affects women, because it does a really good job at kind of feeling like walking you through, here was the recovery process from escaping a relationship like that. And as a result, Evan Rachel Wood has gone on to form an organization that is essentially trying to open up the limitations for legal charges in many states, because often there's a statute of limitations of like, you know, 3 months or a year after you get out of a relationship like this before you can actually, you know, before you can no longer press charges against your abuser. And her whole thing is like, that's not enough time, because up until this point, like 2021, I guess, when they were making this documentary, and she got out of that relationship when, like 10 years ago, she was actually afraid for her safety to name that it was Marilyn Manson. That she's afraid that if she actually named who her abuser was, even though a lot of people knew because that's who she's in a relationship with, but the moment when she dropped his name, that's when her life gets really dangerous. And she had to make sure that there was enough of a support structure in place that would protect her and her family before she could do that. And so a lot of it is about her organization, the Phoenix organization, which is basically trying to get the laws changed in many states to open up that statute of limitations so that women have a chance to go through a healing process before they have to take on something as traumatic as, you know, pressing charges.
Oh, that's okay. So that makes sense about the title of the documentary, which is Phoenix Rising. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I'm absolutely where it comes from.
I have a lot of, they're not mixed. They kind of are. When I was in high school, Marilyn Manson was kind of like my god. He was like the anti-establishment. I don't even remember how many t-shirts I had. I must have seen him in concert three or four times. And I never gave it a second thought. And it wasn't until, you know, a number of years ago when I started kind of looking back when because there was always the talk that was always like, well, you know, he's kind of a weirdo. And it was always like, well, that's fine. Right.
Yeah, that's part of his shtick. That's part of his.
It is. Exactly.
He meant to try to like make people off put. That was his whole
thing. That was the goal. And that's what was attractive about him. Not in like a sexual way or anything like that, like please, but just like that. That's what was attractive about the shtick. So I still feel kind of like I've been blindsided, even though I had like no direct relationship or anything. But I feel like the me that thought she was smart and bucking the trend, I feel like I was lured into this. I feel duped. I feel like such an idiot. Yeah, and I'm still... like I every once in a while I still think about it and I'm like, what? And then this always brings up the constant debate of, for me at least, I still have trouble separating the art from the artist. And in some instances, I find that that's easier to deal with than with others. And for Marilyn Manson specifically, I just stopped listening to the music. I blocked it on Spotify. It just never comes up on my playlists. And I'm fine with it. Like, it doesn't affect me in any way anymore. But I think back to like 18 and 19 year old me that was completely obsessed. And I'm like, God, I was such an idiot. But I have mixed emotions.
There's no way you could have known.
No, but still.
I like his music too. I wasn't in as deep as you. I didn't have any t-shirts or I never saw him live or anything like that. But there was always a sort of projection that he was like leaning into kind of like this satanic panic image to basically be exactly what people would accuse him of being, which would take away the power of the accusation. And there was a countercultural aspect to that that was incredibly alluring, especially for younger people who are, you know, when you're a teenager and you're very much in that, like, you know, fuck you kind of attitude. That's like catnip.
And totally.
And if you dig his music, and it was very easy to dig his music too, some of it was legit good, you know? And I'm the same way. I'll never listen to another Marilyn Manson song for the rest of my life. It just... gone. A certain, like, everyone has to make their own decisions about where their own comfort levels lie. I never want to tell anyone, it's like, oh, you're not allowed to listen to that, or you're not allowed to watch that movie anymore. Everyone can decide for themselves where their comfort levels lie. And the amount of shit that Marilyn Manson did, in which I do 100% believe Evan Rachel Wood and everything that she says, it's you know, when someone's hanging up signs in their private bedroom that just says kill all Jews, it's like, at a certain point, you're just a fucking Nazi and I'm not gonna listen to your music anymore. That's a decision I made for me. So he got to such a point of monstrous behavior that I'm like, I'm not even gonna wrestle with the problematic elements of the artist because I like the art. I just gotta cut this off because
exactly. Yeah, I feel 100%.
I'm not going to deal with any sort of like moral wrestling with it at this point.
Yeah, and I feel exactly the same. I have with some, I do still have that moral wrestle, and with others, I don't. And this is definitely a point where I don't. I just don't fucking care.
Yeah.
You could burn in hell for all I care. I finally finished, and I say finally because I did start the season when it went live, and then I got busy and then I never caught up with it, but I was determined to finish off a season 2 of Euphoria. So I finished it the other day. This show, man, I don't even know. Like, season, do you watch Euphoria?
I haven't watched any of Euphoria yet, and I keep wondering if this is a show I should be watching.
I think you would appreciate it. It is a really smart, like, people have compared it to kind of like a darker version of My So-Called Life. It is, in some aspects it is, because it's a more, okay, a more somewhat realistic look at teenagers, but I say somewhat because I don't know. It's not real. Let's be honest. But it does. It tackles certain parts of being a teenager in a very straightforward and relatable way. Like, they openly talk about relationships and sex and self-exploration and drugs. And it's very like the reactions are all very real, though some of the situations are completely ridiculous, And the show kind of centers on a group of teenagers that have kind of like intertwining relationships. They're not all friends, but they kind of all know each other. And in season 2, the show begins and it feels like, I don't even know what it feels like. It feels, it does not feel like season 1 of Euphoria. It feels like, what is the show with, oh my God, I've totally forgotten it. The A&E show, was it A&E? Now I can't even remember. With Mr. White. What the hell was the name of that show?
Not sure.
Okay, I don't remember. My mind has gone blank. Okay. Whatever. It feels like a totally different show. It kind of loses its way. It's all about drugs and drug dealing and like the underbelly. Most of the high school stuff has gone out the window for the first like 2 episodes. And then it kind of finds its way back. And then the final 2 episodes are so genius. Like, episode 7 of this season is probably the best thing I've seen on TV in like a decade. It's just the most brilliant thing ever. So at the beginning of the season, one of the sort of secondary characters, maybe even like a third character, is putting together a play. And we kind of see that they're putting together a play, but we don't know what the play is about. And then in episode 7, everybody sits down to watch the play. And it's a play about everybody in high school and all the shit that's happened in the last like 2 years. And so you kind of, you're watching the play, and at the same time, you're seeing the characters kind of reevaluate the events that they lived through. It's just the most genius thing ever. Like, it really, really is. That episode was like, wow, this is working on a level that I did not think was possible. It's so good, to the point I watched it twice. It's totally worth it. And then it kind of wraps up with the final episode, which kind of puts a neat bow on everything. I have no idea if they're going to do any more. I don't follow it enough to know whether they've renewed it for a 3rd season. It would be perfectly fine if it ended where it does, though I would like to see where it goes if they do another one. But wow, this show is so good. And the first, I will warn you, the first couple of episodes of season 1, I was like, this show is fucking dark, like dark. How could anybody watch more than 1 episode at a time? Like, it's not bingeable. The first 3 episodes are so depressing and heartbreaking. I'm like, there's no way I can binge this thing. And then it kind of lightens up a little bit more, but it's good. I really like the season 2 of Euphoria. So I would say,
right. I'll have to dive into it and give the show a shot.
It's good. I really, really enjoyed season 2. It was unexpected, but so good. Let's finish with The Dropout.
Yeah. I want to circle back to this show because you had mentioned the show last on the last episode. And I hadn't seen any of it yet. And so now that it's actually airing, I think there's like 5-6 episodes, something like that. I'm deep into the show now. And I mentioned this before that I've consumed so much doc info about the Elizabeth Holmes story that I feel like there's nothing new that this show really has to kind of tell me about like what actually happened. But at the same time, this is, I think, the first dramatization of it that we're seeing in basically like a narrative form instead of like a doc form. So I was interested to watch it, and I'm such a sucker for this story. I don't know why. It's just like I will consume anything and everything about this story. I'm just like quietly obsessed with it. And I'm actually really enjoying the show. I know you said that it didn't feel like it ended very well. Like it just kind of like, well, we'll stop here. And I suppose that's, you know, kind of because like in real life, the story is like still ongoing. Like as they were making this, she got basically found guilty of fraud. So it's there's only so far that the series can go. And from what I've seen yet, I haven't gotten that far yet. However, I'm actually really enjoying this show a lot. I think it is fairly well done. Maybe not as great as some of the more prestige television that you would see, but I'm still really enjoying it. And especially the two leads of the show, Amanda Seyfried and Naveen Andrews, they are incredible in this show. I don't think it can be understated. If both of them are not nominated for awards, whenever the award season for the Emmys rolls around, it will be a crime, because I think they are doing some next level work in this show. They're both so incredibly good. So if you're at all interested in this story, I think The Dropout is an easy recommend and is worth diving into. I'm really digging it. We'll see how I feel when I get as far as you got to see too. If I maybe feel a little bit let down that the show doesn't, and that the series isn't able to wrap up in a nice way, hopefully they'll come back for like a season two and like continue the story. If there is enough story there, because it's kind of like after the dissolution of the company, there's not a lot there except just waiting for court processes to follow through.
So, you'd have to be dramatizing a whole lot more. Because, I mean, like you say, it's just a lot of waiting for. However, I think that there is an opportunity to maybe expand the story a bit more, because she did find somebody else. She got pregnant. She's found money somewhere. They're living somewhere. And then there's the whole trial ordeal and now the conviction ordeal. And I mean, if they wait long enough, the sentencing ordeal, which I think will be another thing. So, I mean, there is still story to tell, but I think you're right. It might not be quite enough story to tell right now. But I fully agree. I think Naveen Andrews and Amanda Seyfried are doing like amazing work. And I always feel like I'm surprised by Amanda Seyfried. I don't know why.
Yeah.
Because she's such a great actress.
I know what you mean. Every time she shows up, I'm happy that she's there, because it's like, oh, I love you. But at the same time, when she's not there, it's like out of sight, out of mind. You know?
Exactly. This is exactly it. She's just so understated. Like, she's always great. But for whatever reason, like, I just never think of her as like, great actress, until I see her in something. I'm like, great actress.
And I think this is the best thing that she's ever done, hands down.
I would say so, at least for sure, at least in recent memory. I'm sure I've seen other stuff of hers that I really like, but that's like memorable for sure. And she doesn't, she's not in a lot of stuff, which probably doesn't help. She's quite selective about the works that she does. So, which works to her benefit, really. But yeah, this show is, I really enjoyed it, other than, you know, I thought the ending was a bit abrupt, but.
And I really like how the show has kind of, I feel like it struck the perfect balance at getting up this nexus of, yes, Elizabeth Holmes is a fraud who is guilty of every bad decision that she made, which was just bad decision upon bad decision upon bad decision, and is basically completely morally corrupt as a person. But also, she's operating in this world where every dude has gotten away with doing what she's doing. There's a whole part of the film where she basically gets mentored by Larry Ellison, who tells her essentially to do exactly what she's doing.
Yeah.
And that's how, like, he got where he is, as being this mega rich founder of Oracle. And you couple that with, like, her professors in when she was at Stanford. There's a great scene with where she's trying to get the one professor on board with, like, coming onto the board of her company. And she just immediately calls her out and says, no, you need to do better than this, because when the shit gets on fire, they're going to come after you in a way that they aren't going to go after guys. And so you have to cross every T and dot every I, and you have to do it twice, and you have to, you know, work twice as hard and make sure the science works twice as good as everyone else's. And that's just the reality of it. And that's also true. And it sort of gets at the reason why Elizabeth Holmes got taken down is both because she was a fraud, but also because she's a woman.
Yeah. And that
made her an easy target to go after, even if the reasons for going after her are legitimate at just.
Yeah.
And the show finds the perfect balance of, like, getting that point across.
I agree. And that's one of the things that makes their story so interesting. It's in part because if she had been a guy, we wouldn't probably be talking about this. It would have been like a headline, and in a year it would have been gone and we would have forgotten about it. The fact that she's a woman doing things that guys have been doing for decades has gotten her into even more hot water. And that, I think, to me is, you know, one of the reasons why her story is so interesting and why the show is so good. Because, like you say, it does strike that fine balance. I think you're totally right. You've totally nailed it.
Yeah, and so I'm going to stick with this show, and hopefully it'll pan out eventually.
It will. You're almost there. There's, I think, only 7 episodes in the season, so...
Yeah, so I think it's like 1 or 2 more episodes to go.
Yeah, yeah. That's it. We covered a lot of ground today. Lots of great stuff, some really good recommendations, not a lot of stinkers, which is good. That's always good.
Yeah.
I guess the next time we talk, it will...
Counting the Adam Project.
Yeah, well. You can't win them all, man. You can't win them all.
Exactly.
The next time we talk, it'll be post-Oscars.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So I'm sure there will be some passing discussion about that. And which reminds me that I have legitimately a week left to watch Coda.
Yes.
Which I still haven't seen.
Well, I just saw today, apparently, Twitter's having a meltdown.
Totally.
Because I guess Coda won
that PGA
award.
Yeah.
And so people are saying that it's probably the front runner to win at the Oscars. And apparently there's people that are upset at that for some reason. I don't know why.
Yeah, they're calling it the Little Miss Sunshine vote. I'm like, whatever. I haven't seen it yet, so I have yet to make a decision. But I do know,
I need to cross that one off my list too.
Yeah, like in the back of my mind, I have this list of things that I still need to watch. So Coda, The Tragedy of Macbeth. I think those are the two like big gaping blind spots for me. And then I feel okay about the rest of it. I have to look at the full list, but I think I've pretty much covered my bases. Yeah, not that it's going to matter. It's all going to be Dune.
Coda sometime in the next week.
Yeah, me too. Coda and Macbeth. Those are the two that are on my must watch before the awards so that I can feel like, you know, I've made I know what I'm doing.
And Jimmy Cade.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Because, you know, it matters. It matters a lot. It's okay. Well, Dune is going to win all the things, so it doesn't fucking matter at this point. So there was this amazing video of Kristen Stewart presenting that award at the PGA. And the way she says Dune is hilarious. I've been loving my Twitter feed. It's all Kristen Stewart.
How did she say it?
Dune. But it's like, it, you have to listen to it in relation to the rest of the way she presents. I'll link to the video. I'll find the video and I'll link to it because it's pretty funny. But I have to say, I've been loving my Twitter feed for the last 2 weeks because it's all Robert Pattinson and Kristen Stewart. And I feel like 2008 is back, except less angsty and way hotter than it ever was like 12 years ago.
Yes.
I'm totally here for it. Sorry?
And much gayer.
And much gayer. Yes. I'm in here for all of it. I don't care. I'm waiting for the moment. Like, there was the this week it was the Andrew Garfield, Robert Pattinson reunion at some dinner. I'm like, give me Kristen Stewart and Robert Pattinson in a picture together at the Oscars, and like the year is made. It's made. And that was my digression into hysterics. I don't know why, but that makes me very happy and very giddy for like no reason.
They need to cast Kristen Stewart as like Poison Ivy.
I would totally watch this. Let's make it happen. Oh. Come on, people. It's got to happen. It's got to happen.
Now. And the Batman fans would melt down. Why are you twilighting my Batman?
And I'd be like, I'm here for all of it. Yeah. Give it to me. And with that, twilighting Batman. Oh, I love it. I love it. Oh, okay. Come on by atcpod.ca. Links to all of the things we talked about today. Ashley, where can folks find you?
People can find me on Twitter at Ashley Lynch.
And you can find me at The Marina. And until next time.
Insert catchphrase here.
Opening and closing credits are Happy Alley by composer Kevin MacLeod. For more information, visit incompetech.com.